Welcome to the Sound on Sound People and Music Industry podcast channel with me, Kevin Paul. This month we have another legacy episode with award-winning engineer, producer and mixer Alan Mulder. Alan has recently picked up the prestigious Music Producers Guild Icon of the Year award, and I thought it appropriate to share again his episode when he sat down with me in 2019. Hello, Alan. Great to be here. Thanks for being on Mixbus. First question, what went wrong with your career?
I've been very lucky. I started at a time when alternative music wasn't really something everybody wanted to do. It was actually something people tended to avoid, or it was kind of known more as indie rock then. And I started in 84, and people in those days were kind of into being Trevor Horn and making those great big slick productions, which, you know, I like, and everyone wanted to show off being an engineer, their prowess. And nobody really wanted to do the indie records because they generally didn't sound very good. So I kind of liked that music, and I got into it through... I knew Alan McGee, who owned Creation Records, Alan McGee and Dick Green. I went to school with Dick Green in Lincolnshire, weirdly enough, and so we knew each other before they had Creation Records. So when they formed Creation Records, and I was at Trident, I was kind of a trained engineer, which generally the indie bands couldn't afford. They went to smaller studios. So I got to work with some Creation bands, and there was no real competition. You know, nobody really wanted to do that stuff, and I loved it. So I started, it was me and Flood, basically. We were the two who liked that kind of weirdo music, as they called it. And so we got a flying start. Then Nirvana came along, and suddenly alternative rock and indie rock, you know, suddenly people were selling records, and then all the big engineers wanted to do those records. But Flood and I had got the track history from the Valentines and the Mary Chain, and with Flood, the mute bands that he did. So we had a good head start. So I think that worked out well for us.
Yeah. Is that where you started, at Trident?
I started at Trident, yeah.
And what was that like?
It was four of the most exciting years of my life. I didn't sleep.
Still.
I didn't sleep. I didn't make any money. I was poverty stricken, but I mean, the people that were there at the time, this Flood was the main guy. He was the head engineer. We had Spike Stent, we had Cenzo Townsend, Steve Osborne, Paul Corkett, and I'm sure I've missed some people out, but it was a pretty good roster of people there, and we were all great friends.
Yeah.
Everyone was still in competition with everyone, but it was not a backbiting competition. It was very supportive.
Sure.
It was tough, but it was really good fun. I learned so much.
Yeah.
I'd finally found the job that I wanted to do. I started late. I didn't start till I was 24. Suddenly I'd found this thing that I fell in love with and just devoted all my life to.
Did you have any idea that you wanted to be in the studio, or how did you get to that Trident place at 24?
I'd been in local bands in Boston, Lincolnshire, where I'm from. And, you know, you always dream of making it in a band. And
yeah,
it's not going to happen there. But, you know, certainly in those days it wasn't going to happen. And then I went into a studio and saw that to do a demo, and just thought, I like this. You know, this is great. And then I just kind of realised, I was working for the Ministry of Agriculture at the time, and I kind of realised, you know, what am I doing? You know, this is... I liked the job, but, you know, I didn't want to do it for the rest of my life. And I thought, well, just take a risk and just... Those days, you just got a job in a studio. There weren't all the schools. There was only the Tom Meister course. And I didn't do A-level music or maths, so I wasn't going to do that.
That's the one at Surrey University.
Surrey University, yeah. That was the... Still going.
Yes.
Still good, but it was more for BBC-type people then.
Okay.
So you just got a job in studios as an assistant in those days, or T-boy, as it was. It used to be the runner, as they're now. We used to call them T-boys. And I managed to get a job, and that was it. I thought, this is heaven. First day in a studio, Monday, I think it was Monday the 2nd of December. I turned up at 9 o'clock and left 9 o'clock the next morning.
Wow, that's a great start.
It was baptism of a fire, but it was brilliant. You know.
So you worked at Trident for 4 years.
Yeah.
And obviously you managed to stay the distance, as it were.
Yeah.
What happened then? Did you just go freelance? Did you move to another studio?
Well, Chardon got sold. They sold it to another company, Audio One, I think. And they kept one of the buildings, but basically it sold. So I was lucky enough that I'd got enough clients that I could keep going. I got managed by David Stewart from the Eurythmics. Okay. He set up a management company because he got so much work that he couldn't do. He wanted a management company of people that he could give work to. Mm. My now wife, then girlfriend, was signed to his label. So he knew me from working on her albums, yeah. Tony Halliday.
Yeah.
And so he took me on. And so I got to work with Eurythmics and some of his bands that were on Anxious label, yeah. And his then wife at the time, Siobhan Fahey. So I did Shakespeare's Sister. So I worked on her albums too.
And the record industry then was a very different thing, wasn't it?
It was, yeah.
People couldn't spend their money on video games and streaming and stuff.
You know, that's
music
it.
Was the primary kind of form of entertainment.
It was. It was things that people turned to.
Yeah. The industry had huge budgets to make really great records.
Yeah.
Obviously, we're still making great records. We just don't have that budget anymore.
No, all time.
All time. Yes, indeed. How do you manage to still produce the same quality of work without that budget? You must have had to change maybe your style or your workflow or what would have happened to you?
Yeah, you have to adapt. You definitely have to adapt. We're lucky enough to have this studio.
Yeah.
So I've got a great room, which has got a great mixing desk in it. We've stuck to the old big desks. I mean, I work in the box, but I've got the desk. I've got lots of outboard gear I've been lucky enough to accumulate. So I have a room that enables me to have a quality.
Mm. Is it fair to say that you mainly do a lot of mixing now?
I do more mixing, than production.
Is that something you sought to do or you just sort of fell into? Is that where you're most happiest in the studio?
It is where I'm most happiest. I think it's come from my time at Trident. When I joined, they'd just taken on the second studio, which was in Victoria, and it had an SSL. It was the first SSL Trident had. And I got sent over there at the beginning, and I learned the desk really quick. I worked out, nobody really knows how to use this.
Right.
So I learned it really quick. So I ended up, if there was a session in there, I got put on it because I knew the studio.
Okay.
And those days, people would come in to try, they'd come in for a day to try the studio out. And they'd probably, some people coming in to try SSLs out. So I managed to get a good grasp on that room.
Yeah, sure. Took the initiative.
I took, I learned it and it worked out great because I got all the sessions in there.
Right.
And they were the best paying sessions there and the best clients. But the downside was people would come in for a day. And that would mean they'd work 24 hours and then I'd have to work the next day. So, so you didn't get much sleep, but it enabled me to learn that console really well. And so I end up spending a lot of my time mixing as a mixing assistant rather than a tracking assistant.
Okay.
So I think that's probably where it came from in the first place.
Yeah.
And now I kind of like it. I think it's what I'm best at. I like producing.
Yeah.
But it has to, I know the bands that I think I'll be good for a producer to produce, and I know the ones that I don't think I'll be able to provide what they need or want.
Okay. I prefer mixing. It's just, for me, it's somewhere where I feel I can add the most value.
I like the challenge that it's down to you.
Yeah.
If you've got to get the thing past the post. Every day you've got to hit the ball out of the park. You've got to get a tick. Sure. So it's a challenge, and I like that. You get addicted to that kind of
For sure. You
challenge.
You definitely get addicted to that kind of expectation and desire. We spoke a little bit about the studio here.
Yeah.
How long have you and Flood been in charge of this place?
We started off taking on my mix room downstairs. That's the first room we took on. I think that was about 15 years ago, I think. And that was the only room we had here. And slowly, we've taken over most of the rooms in the building. After that, we took over this room, AMB2, the tracking room, which was run by Barney, who's the tech staff. And we put a Neve console in and we got our tracking room, the idea was downstairs would be my room, the upstairs would be Flood's room.
Okay. You have a very good program of bringing people through. We spoke about Catherine.
Yeah.
You got Caesar, who you said.
Cecil Bartlett. Adam Bartlett. He's doing very well. He's been working with a lot of artists.
if I'm looking to get a job in the studio and somehow I wind up at the door of Battery, what are you looking for from me? What makes you decide to hire Tom as opposed to hire somebody else? What is it that you're looking for in an assistant to come into the studio? Is it education from college? Is it something else? What are you looking for?
It's their personality. It's funny because we got a lot of people there and they're all completely different. Completely different people and personalities. But there's a common thread of their passion for what they do that they all have. Everyone's got that same ambition and passion. So I'm looking for some of them have been to school, some of them haven't been to school. It makes no difference to us because really they learn technique from school and they learn technical stuff, which is great.
Yeah.
But they don't learn how to be in a session and they don't learn a lot of the other stuff that we take for granted. So you're kind of starting from the ground up already.
Okay, so again. You sort of strip them all back down and say, I got what you've learned.
They generally come on work experience.
That's how
we generally find them on work experience. So I know people say about the work experience thing being a bad thing.
Yeah.
Not for the people who've come here. We've got them all from work experience.
Yeah.
Catherine came over from Australia just to work with Flood, and then she ended up with me. And then Caesar came with work experience from Lipper, and he knew so much about computers, I thought, we need a guy to run our rigs.
Okay.
I think Flood took on Cecil, and I took on Caesar.
Yeah.
And they come in we just see something in the people. Okay. And Tom, same thing, he comes in, his knowledge of music is amazing, his depth of knowledge of music. You used to think, okay, well, that guy has got an ear.
He understands it.
Yeah, he understands it. And it's just, you just get a feeling from them.
Sure.
And what ends up is they end up not going home, or they turn up and they won't go. So you end up having to employ them, kind of.
I guess it's that doggedness, though, that actually shows their desire.
That's it. The guys who come and work experience at Leave on the dot of five, you're not going to warm to them as much as the one who's there till... I mean, some of them have to leave at five because they've got to get home
but
as a generalisation, you spot the ones that are really in it for the right reasons. And sometimes with work experience, you get people come in and at the end of it, they go, I've realised this job isn't for me.
Sure.
Because, as you know, it's not for everyone, this. If you don't absolutely love it, it's going to kill you.
Well, it's a lifestyle, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
It's a vocation.
Yeah.
That's what I see anyway.
And between Flood and I, we always try and make sure that they work for both of us.
Okay.
Because we are very, very different how we work. And it teaches them completely different things, which I think gives them a much rounder education.
How do you work?
I'm very methodical.
Okay. Can you,
like a classic mix engineer.
You maybe describe that a little bit deeper? Like, so you're mixing a band, for instance. Do you have a set way of working in terms of approaching a song?
Or? It's just how it's set up. I want it set up a certain way just from the start. But when I actually approach it to mix it, no, it's not really the same.
Not really the same.
I try, and if I do an album, to give each album a different kind of, okay, I'm going to use more different stuff on this or something, to keep me interested, really, as much as anything.
Yeah, so it's not mixing by numbers. And
no,
it,
I can't. I've tried that. I can't do it. Doesn't work. So I'm very organised and very structured.
You mean with your Pro Tools or your desk?
Everything is tidy and kind of
okay.
We have a system.
Okay.
And that's kind of thing. Flood is chaos. And his genius comes from managing to work in this chaos where everyone thinks, what is happening? And suddenly something great appears. So they learn both sides and the value of both sides.
Sure. How do you encourage those people that work with you to venture out? They're almost like your children in some way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and you've spent a lot of time nurturing them and showing them the studio. How do you sort of encourage them to go out into the world? What's their... I know you're not necessarily responsible for them building their careers, but you obviously have an influence to them.
We introduce them to clients, and so they get to meet people, and we actively promote them when we are,
okay.
Have yeah. record companies or bands. And so they'll probably end, they'll start off maybe doing B-sides for them or live mixes. Yeah. They start to get our client base. Which you feed them in. So yeah. then they start, then the record company will be aware of them. And so they'll think, okay, well, let's give them, you know, we've only got this amount of money, let's try yeah. these people. So excellent. We kind of pass on our clients to them.
Yeah.
And then it gets to a point where they get taken out of the studio. They want to take them on to do a project somewhere else.
Yeah.
And so they get their own clients and then it kind of goes off. What I do love about this place is they come back to work in the rooms and yeah. we try and provide this as a home or a base for them to come yeah. back to, because what's great is you're in a room. There's people around all the time. Yeah. This place, as you can see, we don't spend money on the decor. The doghouse, which is an old tape store, which we've converted into a room because Flood was ending up running out of time on album or budget on albums. So we managed to create a room for him where he could finish them off. When the budget had gone, and so we got these little rooms that people go in and just make music, and it's great. So, I mean, yeah, people who come here either get it or they don't. They either don't like Willesden. And it's not plush enough for them, yeah. or they just get a sense of the building and the creativity. We had Duran Duran here this year a lot.
Oh, what was that like?
Well, I thought they're going to hate it. They're, you know, this ain't Rio. You know, no, you just think of their videos.
Yeah,
they loved it, and they come back because they get the place, which was a joy to us.
That's the highest compliment, isn't it? When people come back.
Yeah.
When you start a mix, what?
The first thing I do is I listen to the reference mix from top to bottom.
Okay.
And then I will decide whether I'm going to mix it on the board or in the box. Sometimes I'll break it out at the desk. I'll print it in the box, a mix in the box, and then I'll break it out on the desk and just run it through the desk and listen to the two and decide which suits it better.
Okay.
Sometimes budget will dictate whether I just go straight in the box because it takes longer the desk. Because if I'm using the desk, I'll get it to a point, then it'll be stemmed extensively and I'll go back in the box. So it always ends up back in the box because you do so many tweaks these days, you have no choice really.
Yeah.
Once I've decided which I'm going with, old school, I start with the drums and bass and I will start from where that person is, what they've given me, and shape within that.
Yeah, because those reference mixes or rough mixes is what we're called, they're not necessarily rough or reference mixes anymore.
A lot of the sounds and stuff that are their plugins are the production.
Yeah.
Sometimes people, because of budgets, they have to record very quickly. It's changed. It used to be you'd spend a long time recording and then mix it in a day.
Yeah.
Now sometimes I think we spend longer mixing it than they've spent recording it because that's the way it is. So a lot of the effects that are in the box are part of the production. So you can't really sweep the board and start again, I find.
Yeah, that makes sense, doesn't it? Because they're almost partly mixing from the first
From the beginning, yeah. And I find that what I tend to do is there'll be a lot of stuff across the mix bus these days. That's
okay.
That comes in, so I take that off. And I try and get it. My first thing would be trying to get it sound like the ref mix without the stuff on the mix bus.
Okay.
As you know, the mix bus makes it sound exciting, the processing, but when it gets loud, the dynamics are gone, you're losing all the transients. So I try and get it to feel like that. If you can get it to feel like that without the stuff on the mix bus, you're in a great shape because you're getting all the air and the depth.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
But what the ref mixes generally nail is the excitement and what the producer wants to hear.
The intention.
Yeah, the intention.
So you're working on your drums. Mm-hmm. Do you use any form of replacement or sample?
I enhance. I don't replace. Yeah. The first job an assistant gets when they come to me is MIDI mapping.
Right.
So I don't use the quick replacements. I get them to MIDI map it.
Okay, and that's like using contact or something
I use
like
battery.
That. Battery, okay. Right.
Battery and...
appropriately.
Yes, exactly. So they do that MIDI mapping, which is a skill in its own.
Sure.
Yeah. Making sure that you don't miss the ones. Also, sometimes when people have edited drums in a hurry, there'll be what I call a false transient at the beginning.
Yeah.
And when you do the tap to transient, it'll go on the wrong one. Right. So the samples will be slightly off. So then you actually have to go and see, you'll see where the real transient is when you zoom in, and then you have to move them all. So it takes a while.
Yeah.
But then once you got them, it's all, you know, you can change samples, add samples, everything's phase coherent.
So that's quite meticulous. That's obviously very important, isn't it?
Yeah.
Getting that right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I've listened to a lot of your work over the years.
Right.
And your mixes always just have this incredible intensity to them that, for the love of God, I cannot get anywhere near. How are you managing to get that intensity? Because are you using saturation? Are you driving the mix bus? Are you doing both? Are you using distortion somewhere?
I really don't know. I generally don't like the way things sound. So okay. I keep struggling to try and get it to a point where I don't hate it, the way it sounds. And I don't settle very easily on something. So I keep pushing myself to try and get it how I find it, how I want to hear it.
Okay.
Which sometimes I don't know. I just keep trying stuff. A lot of stuff doesn't work. So I just keep trying stuff until something happens. And sometimes you'll just be exasperated and try a piece of gear that you think you hate.
Yeah.
And then that piece of gear just saves your bacon.
Right.
I do like stuff to be quite intense. I think it's from... Yeah, I think you're shaped by the music you grow up with.
Yeah, I mean, you did a load of the Nine Inch Nails stuff, which was probably as intense as it could ever be.
Yeah, that's one of my favourites.
I mean, I'm sure there was an education, a learning curve there from Trent, you know.
Yeah, okay, and... from the Mary Chain.
Right, okay. And, yeah, and
so that was pretty good.
Have you carried that with you?
Some good violence.
Have you carried that? Some good violence.
Good musical violence.
Yeah, yeah. Have you carried that with you?
I those are the bands I love. Yeah. I love that intense.
I mean, but it's not to suggest that you only work with that band, because you do nice, pleasant indie music.
Yeah.
As well. It's not everything you do
true. No, it's true, but you know. A lot of it is.
No, a lot of it is, yeah, for good measure, good reason.
I guess it's because I do get a lot of stuff that's quite dense.
Right.
That's what people probably think, oh, this has got a hell of a lot of stuff on it. I'd probably be good for doing it. Yeah. So I don't know. There's no real plan behind it all.
Right. You're just trying stuff, and then when you feel the magic...
Yeah, okay, that's not working, let's try this. Yeah. Okay, that's not working, let's try this. Okay, that... I really wish it was, I know what to do with this one, because I'd be a lot quicker. I'm not very quick.
How long does it take you to do a mix?
It varies. It's generally more than a day.
More than a day?
Okay. Generally a day to do battle with sounds.
Right.
And then the next day, I come in and... it's a song again. I hear it as a song and I start to work on making it better as a song rather than pulling my hair out about drums, which is what we all do.
Which we all do, drums and bass, right? Drums and bass, where we're going, how we get that bass to sound good.
Yeah, how we get everything to sound clear,
Is there a piece of equipment that you use all the time? Or is there a favourite process that you're always using in the studio when it comes to your mixes? What is there something that you carry with you, kind of from track to track, album to album, session to session? Or has that changed?
They kind of change around. I've got an Alicia compressor that I really love, that I use on drums.
In what way do you use it on the drums?
As a parallel. I love it because you can... there's an EQ filter on it, so you can send the kit to it and roll the top off so you don't get just the cymbals through it.
Okay, yeah.
I've got a newer one. I've got a Overstayer stereo compressor, which I love. There's got the filters on that Overstayers are kind of synth-based rather than EQ-based, so they have a different tone, and the compression on it, it's really, really good. And it's got a mix knob on it, which is brilliant.
So which is always helpful.
Those two things I'm using a lot. I've got an EMI or Chandler EMI TG1 compressor, which I love on vocals on limiter. It makes life hard for you because it brings out all the pops and the S's and the T's and all the dirt in between.
Yeah.
But singers seem to like it, gives it like a little bit of drive and it just sits.
Do you use a lot of limiting in the mix?
I don't use limiting much apart from, I guess I do really. I mean, everyone does these days. I use the TG1 hardware, but I use some of the software ones. I use the Renaissance Axe a lot on basses, the R bass, very simple kind of limiters.
Is there a consistent mix bus that you use?
Not really. On the desk, I'm on the desk, I have a Obsidian compressor, which is like the SSL one, very like the SSL one, but it's got a high pass filter in it.
Okay.
And I think this SSL one sounds great for drums. This one sounds better for guitars.
When you stem off your work, you said that you do some intricate stems. How detailed are we talking about here? Are we talking about literally individual, every single track? And what about reverbs?
Well, the drums now will be stemmed individually. We worked out a system where I can stem the kick snare separately, and then what will happen is what's across the drum bus will go back on. We'll stem them with that off.
Okay, right.
But it'll go through, sometimes I run it through to generate some Helios for the line amps rather than the SSL.
Okay.
And it just makes it a bit more open. And through, sometimes I've got an inward connection EQ that will sometimes do the bottom and top. So they'll be printed through those.
Yeah.
And then they go back in. So the drums will be, I mean, if there's a top and bottom mic, that'll be printed as one.
Yeah, sure.
So it's not all, it's just the core, like the kick, the snare, the toms, the overheads, the rooms, they'll all be printed separately. Then the guitars, obviously, if there's separate mics, they'll be bounced to a stereo rather than all the separate mics.
Okay.
And the bass will be one. So,
and what about your reverbs? Are you printing guitars with effects, or are you separating your effects out even with your stems?
No, on the vocals they'll be separated out. I've got an EMT plate that we'll use, and that'll be stemmed separately. And I've got an AMS DMX 15, which I love. That will be recorded. So all the effects will be recorded.
It's literally the mix in the box.
Somebody stays up all night doing it. Tom, now. It was Caesar. Now, Tom.
One track at a time. Yeah. 4 minutes.
We call it Stem Party for One.
You've got the glitter ball. You can put that on. Listen,
I leave about 9 or 10 o'clock. And see you tomorrow, Tom.
And he's still here at 9 or 10 o'clock.
He's here pretty late,
Have you got any sort of suggestions for things to try to avoid rather than things to try to do?
Well, we've touched on it with limiting. You get reference mixes that are so loud now.
Yeah.
And I understand why. We all understand why. But it starts... Then what happens is you feel like you have to compete with it, because can you trust the people to... when you're listening back, to not compare it on their laptop to their reference mix and be just impressed by the volume. So if you can calm that down, and sometimes limiting is used to make up for poor production. The excitement comes from limiting rather than a performance or the sounds.
Okay.
Which again, I understand, we're all up against the time crunch. But the hard work you put in at the beginning makes everything else better, and everything goes down the line feeling better. So I just say, just try to avoid not crushing the life out of everything.
I don't see how you have too many problems with the loudness of your records compared to others.
Well, you do.
Yours are pretty loud.
Well, that's
they're
only,
right up there.
That's only because...
How do you deal with that? Okay, so say, your client comes in and has got a rough mix and it's, 7 decibels of gain on the limiter, and it's just absolutely, squared off completely.
It's the bane.
How do you deal with that in terms of not necessarily your style of mixing, because you're not going to change what you do to compete with it?
But you have to compete with it.
Do you ever end up having to say to the client, don't listen to the rough mix for volume, because it's not going to be that?
I will say I couldn't get my mix as loud, your mix is 2 dBs louder than mine. So if you're comparing it, turn that mix down 2 dBs.
Okay, yeah.
And I'll explain why. I don't want to sound like somebody who's saying, oh, modern, this is how modern life is. It's, this bottle's been there since the 60s.
Yeah, sure.
You know,
sure.
People trying to, we're using limiting and trying to get things loud. And there's always the, oh, the Americans get more bottom end on their tracks and they're louder in the 60s. It's been going on forever.
Okay.
It's just different set of rules now, or it's different set of toys.
Are you referring to the rough reference mix a lot while you're working?
A lot, yeah. I reference the reference mix a lot.
That's interesting for people to hear, because I think, you know, when you're starting out mixing, you know, we all have that, you're never sure if what you're doing is good.
When I started out, I used to A-B to CDs all the time.
Okay.
I would, I think when I went to the Smashing Pumpkins, and I remember the first day, we were listening to stuff we'd done, and Butch Vig was playing some mixes he'd done or he'd worked on, and they were listening to some of mine, and I thought, I got some stuff to learn here. And so I started A-B-ing constantly to records that I thought sounded amazing. It's a frustrating process of trying stuff out, fiddling, getting annoyed, and
trying more stuff.
Somehow getting there, getting to a point where you don't hate it, or you're in the ballpark. And that's once you got to that point, it's like, you can start to enjoy yourself a bit more.
Yeah, okay, it's you versus the track.
Yeah.
I think that's a great place to leave it. Alan,
Thanks, Kevin.
Absolutely pleasure. I think you're going to share lots of stuff that people are really going to enjoy.
I hope so.
And thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening, and be sure to check out the show notes page for this episode, where you'll find further information along with web links and details of all our other episodes. And just before you go, let me point you to the SoundOnSound.com/podcasts website page, where you can explore what's playing on our other channels. This has been a Mixbus production by me, Kevin Paul, for Sound on Sound.